Hello, this is Dr. Stephen Nurse, and this is my third and final series on the war in Vietnam, titled, A Letter is a Living Voice. We will be reading letters and documented accounts written by Vietnam veterans. These letters show all the emotion of war, from fear to anger to love and fellowship. These are only the opinions of the writers of the documents and not those of the voice of Vashon or the readers. In addition, while some of the language in the documents may appear to be racially insensitive, it is the actual language of war. It is my opinion that to use the exact language to give the listener a true understanding of the veterans' ratings and their associated emotions is extremely important. In war, we demonize our enemy through our language and our pictures. We make them inanimate, therefore easier to kill. Wait a minute, wait a minute. Wait a minute, please make the postman wait. Wait a minute, wait a minute. Hello, this is Dr. Steve Nurse, and today we're doing an interview. And we're doing an interview with Paul O'Connell. Paul can tell us some more about his experiences and when he was in Vietnam, but he is a Vietnam veteran, and he is from Quincy, Massachusetts, as there were people from every nook and cranny in the United States that were in Vietnam. You know, overall, over 2.7 million persons were in Vietnam that were in uniform. And right now, Paul is sitting on a beach in Florida. I don't know if it's on a beach, but anyhow, Paul, welcome. And thank you for doing this interview.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. And Paul, you're probably about, you said that you were about 2 years younger than me. You're about 72. And I looked at your Facebook page and all that, and my gosh, you look great for 72. You look much better than me. I'm embarrassed to say. But anyhow, tell me a little bit about, first of all, Paul, just kind of give me a little timeline of your life. I mean, started into the military very early. Why don't you just start there?
Well, I joined the Marine Corps on February 19th of 1968. I actually, some things, I just tell because they're fact. My wife always says, don't be proud of it, but I get myself thrown out of high school in December of my senior year. I didn't mean to, but I struck a teacher that got me thrown out of high school. There was no alternative learning back then. I floundered for about a month or so and decided to join the Marine Corps. It's kind of ironic. I was tired of people telling me what to do, so I joined the Marine Corps.
Yeah, there you go.
yeah.
Yeah, that's a little ironic. Okay. That's great.
So I was, 17, about 17 and a half, and I get down to Parris Island. I weighed 130 pounds.
Yeah,
had never played.
And the picture that I saw of you, I think you'd be barely pushing 130 pounds. So,
yeah. And somehow I made it through boot camp. The drill instructors told me, he says, if they didn't need fresh bodies in the foxhole, I would have never made it. But The day I joined the Marine Corps, the North Vietnamese flag was flying in on the flagpole in Way City during the Tet of 1968, just to put where it wasn't a good time, I guess, to join the service, but I did it to escape.
Uh-huh. As an alternative, I mean, yeah. And I think that there were probably a lot of other young men in that same situation as you. Not sure necessarily what they wanted to do. Maybe issues with family, issues with school, and The military at that point was certainly ready to grab anybody up. And you also mentioned to me that you were fire chief or something for after you got back out of country.
I went on to, I'm a fourth generation firefighter in the city of Quincy, and seven members had served on the department. In fact, when I went on, the day I went on, that made three generations on the job.
Wow.
Strange as it may be, 16 years into being on the fire department, I made fire chief in the same city I had gotten thrown out of high school.
Yeah.
And that guy, people used to say, is that the same Paul O'Connell?
Yeah. Yeah.
I know. I got a turnaround. I got, not to get ahead of myself, but I got a turnaround as a result of Vietnam and the Marine Corps. But
yeah.
We'll get to there.
You know, I think that a lot of us have those turnarounds. I wound up before I retired as a college professor at a little college in the central part of the state. And one of the times when I was back there teaching, I thought to myself, you know, I am actually teaching in a class that when I took it, I slept through it, you know. So we do have those turnarounds, that's for sure. Well, let's talk a little bit about your experiences in Vietnam. And one of the questions that I have asked to everybody, and I'm really anxious to hear your response, is when you first hit Vietnam, what was your first impression when you hit the ground in Vietnam off the first plane?
That everything seemed to be gray. There were bunkers. There was gray sandbags. The sky was gray. Gray and barbed wire.
Gray and barbed wire.
Yeah, and I don't know. When I look back, I was probably in a state of shock and didn't know it.
Yeah, yeah. And you landed.
I don't know if it was always planned or not, but there was a plane. We taxied in. There was a plane beside us, and they were putting caskets on board.
Oh,
and
wow.
I started to wonder later on if that was the ploy. I don't know.
You know, to kind of make you kind of aware of what was going on there, to scare you or to do. Yeah, yeah. Very interesting. How about smells? How about smells or temperature or things like that?
Well, it was the beginning of monsoon. It was hot. It was muggy. It smelled the vegetation. They put us on buses. Buses had no windows, but the wire across it, so they couldn't. The enemy supposedly couldn't throw in hand grenades on us or whatever. And
interesting.
The gentleman sitting beside me, I had gone to high school with. He was a year older than me.
Wow!
And in my book, Jim Petiti was his name. And we had gone through infantry training together, and he was on the he sat beside me on the plane, and he sat beside me on that bus. And I don't really remember us. I know for sure we didn't talk. We didn't talk.
Wow.
There was no guys looking out and saying, "Look at this! Look at that! You see that? You see this?" There were. My recollection is that there was no communication.
Uh-huh. Do you know how did he get out of Vietnam, or did you have any contact with him afterwards?
Jimmy spent 1 month in Vietnam. He went up north with the 3rd Marine Division. He got hit in an ambush in the legs. Left out there for the night. He could hear the North Vietnamese. The morning of the Marine unit came in and got him out of there. He did survive. He went on to he had a career in the post office in Quincy, and he's still alive. I see him once in a while. I probably saw him about a year ago.
Wow.
And he tells an interesting story that when we got off the bus, we went into a receiving area. And I was one of the first ones. My name was called out. And the gentleman said, "You're going to the 5th Marine Regiment." And I was all excited. I said, "I'm going to 5th Marine Regiment." And I don't remember this. I only know the story that Jimmy Petiti tells. And Jimmy said that the Marine looked at Jimmy and just shook his head like, that kid has no idea what he's getting into.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. It was a unit that had taken a lot of casualties and stuff.
Yeah. After you got off the bus and they assigned you to that unit, then what happened? Did you immediately, did they take you by helicopter out there, or how did, what transpired then?
It was really strange. We asked people, what's next? And nobody really was telling us. I always figured later on in life, I said, geez, I could have just walked off and come back a year later and said, well, my year's up. I didn't know if I'd be missing. We actually went up to, the Freedom Hill was where Bob Hope used to be. And I think we drank beer. And then that night we went to a transit area and slept in a tent, me and Jimmy Petiti again. And then the next day he went one way because he was going up to the DMZ. And I went to, I think it was called 11th Motor T. And there I got on a helicopter, having no idea where I was going. And the helicopter took me 24 miles southwest of the airport, Da Nang Airport. And I got off the helicopter in the NWA. And I was more or less, I was with nobody I had gone through training with or anything. Got off the helicopter, and there was artillery firing out, so it was outgoing. And yet I didn't know. I didn't know the difference between incoming and outgoing. And but I'm looking, and nobody's running. Nobody's going anywhere. And then I just kept asking, where do I go? I'm new, and they just kept directing me. And I ended up at regimental headquarters, from there to battalion headquarters, from there down to with the unit I was being assigned to, which was Mike Company, 3rd Battalion, 5th Marine Regiment.
And were you there for several days before they sent you out?
You did. You reported in. You did 4 days of indoctrination. You got your weapon, because prior to that, you've got no weapon. You're in that helicopter, you've got no weapon. They give you weapons. One of the first things they did, there was a big map. They pointed on the map where you were located. I was going to tell a story.
Go ahead.
Without a swear. A sergeant major said, he said, listen, we take our time over here. We go slow. And he told that story about one bull saying to another bull. One bull said to another bull, he said, look at the cows down there. Let's run down and screw one. And the other bull says, no, let's go slow. And screw them all.
Yeah.
And that, I never forgot that. I've seen it later on in movies and in books, but that's how they started us. And then we went down, and the company, when I got in country, was out in the field. They were still out, and they were coming in. And the first sergeant told us, go down to the rear gate and watch them come in. And when I saw them come in, they didn't look anything like any Marine Corps I ever knew. You know, they were haggard. They were beat. They were beat. They were filthy. They were. It was unbelievable.
Yeah.
And then I wrote in a letter. I said, and now I'm going to be one of them.
Wow. Wow. And how long was it before you were a rifleman? Is that correct?
I was a rifleman. Yep. 0311. What in the Marine Corps? I was a grunt.
Right.
You were a rifleman, but you were slang was you were a grunt or a ground pounder.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, or a lerp, I guess. Did you then? How long did you go? How long before you went out into the field?
A few days after that, we went out on an old. We went out, and I think back now, maybe it was part of training. I don't know. It didn't say it was. We went out and surrounded a village about, I don't know, just before dark set in, and we stayed there for the night. And the next day we came in. Mike company had taken a lot of casualties, and they were reforming. What I know now, they were reforming, and there was a lot of new guys. And they wanted to break us in, so to give us a night. And then a couple of days later, we went out for 3 or 4 days, going to different villages on search and destroy.
And what were your feelings at that time? Were you excited? Were you apprehensive? Were you a little afraid? What were your feelings when you went out on that search and destroy?
Reality set in. Not the first night. That one wasn't bad. I don't recall feeling any. I was on watch. Again, nothing happened. But when we were going out the next time to the village for the 2 or 3 days, we set in on a piece of high ground, and they fired artillery into this village for, I don't know, an hour or so, and then they did airstrikes. And we were sitting. I really didn't know what was. Some guys were sitting there writing letters while this was going on. And it was the first thought I had that went through my mind that, you know, I could get killed here. But when the time was, you know, ready to move out, I moved out. And not knowing what I really was getting into, mm-hmm. You know. I would have been more scared 6 months later than I was then. Because by 6 months later, I knew what we might get into.
Yeah. You know, that's really, I think that's really an astute comment in that, you know, when we're young, you know, we're afraid of the things that we've experienced. You know, we're not afraid of things that we haven't experienced. You know, in my life, when I think of, you know, different dumb, stupid things that I did in high school and things that I did, drove cars crazy to impress girls, which really is probably not the best way to do it. But, you know, I used to drive out in front of Barbara Hoffman's house and squeal my tires, thinking that was a good way to attract women. And I found it was a good way to piss off her mother. I think that's really an interesting. 6 months later, you had been through a lot of crap. And
6 months later, I had seen dead Marines.
Yeah.
I saw what dead was.
Yeah. And again, that's another thing, too, that we don't see a lot of. You know, when you're 17, you know, maybe grandma or grandpa or, you know, something like that. But you don't see young people that are dead. What were some of your other experiences in the field that stick with you today?
Well, in the beginning was a lot of it. In the beginning was monsoon. We were wet all the time. It was raining all the time. We were doing a little patrolling this area outside of Anwar. We were trying to provide security just for Anwar itself. So we didn't venture much more than a few miles around it. And I didn't see any really. That first village, I did get shot at and didn't know I was getting shot at. I heard what sounded like finger snapping around my head and didn't know what it was. And my fire team leader tackled me. He was a big guy. He tackled me, pounded me, kept me on the ground, yelling at me that I was, you know, what the hell's wrong with you? You're getting shot at and all this. He's screaming, he's swearing. I didn't know.
Wow.
But it was a lot of, but there was a lot of small unit patrols and all of that. And then there was an operation called Operation Mead River, and the whole regiment went but us. And I felt like I got cheated. My company's 3rd Battalion, 5th Marines, we stayed back in the AMWAR to provide security. And the rest of the regiment went out. And that's the first time I heard that somebody I had gone through training with, his last name was Warner, was killed. He got killed in that operation. You know, and one other Marine, I can't think of his name right now. I could come up with it, but I'm not going to waste my mind.
Yeah.
And those were the first two that I heard had got killed.
Wow.
And it made it real, but at the same time, when I look back now, I have PTSD. I'm compensated for it. When I look back, I think getting numb, going numb, not believing it or not, is a gift. It was a gift of God. Because otherwise, if you took it to heart, you're all done.
Yeah.
You're all done. You can't get up in the morning and go out. You're going to, and later on in the book, in my story, I know that. If you come to your senses in a war, you're all done.
Yeah.
You're all done.
It's almost like you don't want. You can correct me if I'm wrong, but it's almost like you don't want to overthink it. You know, you said, you kind of want to remain numb and kind of almost keep yourself away from it and kind of oblivious to the, you know, to all the stuff that's going on around you. You know, and so. What was it like when you were getting close to having your time and getting ready to go back to the United States?
Well, by then, I was more than ready. I had been through a lot. There weren't many of us that did the whole year. I had got wounded. I had been hospitalized. I had.
How were you wounded? So you got a Purple Heart, and
I was wounded on March 3rd, 1969, by I believe it was shrapnel. I might have been shot. I don't know. I was grazed. I ran to the corpsman, thought I was dying. I said, "Do you think I'm dying, Doc?" And one of the first things to treat shock, to treat an injury, you treat shock. And if he had looked at me and said, "Oh, man, you're really hit," I probably would have died of shock.
Yeah.
But he looked at me, and he looked at the wound, and he says, "That's nothing but a paper cut." And it pulled me out of it. It pulled me out of it, and I went back to my fighting hole.
Yeah.
You know?
That's...
And it was, there's a scar there and stuff, but... I was medevaced. I didn't have to go any further than the AMWAR, and I was in the rear for a couple of weeks because I couldn't wear a pack now, because where I got wounded, the strap of the pack was going to be right there and would have kept tearing open that wound.
Yeah. It's interesting, the folks that have... one of my really good friends from high school, Alan Aronica, got 3 Purple Hearts when he was in Vietnam, and it was just how they happened. I mean, it was by the luck of God that in each one of them, he wasn't killed. If he'd been a half second earlier or half second later, that would have been all over. So how was it when you got back? I want to talk a little bit about when you came back to the United States, when you came back to Quincy, were you welcomed? What were you told?
Yeah, I came back. I landed in Boston, Logan Airport. My mother, my father, my grandparents, my aunts, some uncles, my sisters, my brother were all at the airport. There were no, I have no story of people there, you know, going to spit on me and all of that. And,
sure.
I was met by my family. Since you had contacted me, I was trying to have recollection of different things. Again, it's easy to say now I must have been in shock. But I don't remember, what I remember is we went back to my mother's house, and there was coffee and donuts. And recently I've been telling people, never mind that I was 18 when I went to Vietnam. I was only 19 when I came home. I had just turned 19 when I came home from the war.
Wow.
So there was no, I thought my father might greet me with a beer. There was no beer, no. And I woke up the next morning, and I didn't have any civilian clothes. So my mother went to a department store and bought me civilian clothes. So then a buddy of mine come up to pick me up to go out for a ride. I had civilian clothes to wear.
You know, I think that I came from a very small community, and I think even though it was a college town, people were pretty supportive. And we just got about 2 minutes here for this first section. But when you came back and you kind of looked back on it, what were your thoughts? Was it worth it? Was it not worth it? Should you, I'm not trying to get political or anything, but what were your thoughts just in closing here?
I don't think it was. I didn't. I was too young. I had no political thoughts when I went, and I had no political thoughts when I come back. I didn't. This is what I understood when people would ask me, "Did you fight for the flag? Did you fight for this? Did you fight for that?" Once I got over there, I fought to get home.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then there's an underlying thing here, and I have to talk about it for a minute, is that I also received a Dear John when I was in Vietnam. And the biggest thing about coming home, when I got home, she wasn't there.
Wow.
And that played more of a part than almost any of it. The sadness of she wasn't there.
Yeah.
You know, and it's a whole another story. But if somebody was to read my book, they'd get. I don't shy away from that story. That story is in that book.
Well,
and
I think that's
now when I came home to a country that the when I was home on leave, that was the moratorium. Come home for the moratorium, and I was I didn't understand that part.
It's interesting, Paul. I think when you and I talked by telephone earlier, we now said that even though you got that Dear John letter, you've been married for, what, 50 years?
51 years.
All right. So I got 1 year on you. But, and I think what that says is that, I just from knowing you on the radio and myself, our wives are pretty tolerant to put up with us for that long, wouldn't you?
My wife is very tolerant.
Well, good. Well, with that, Paul, we're going to end this segment, and we're going to have some silence after we have the intro or the extra here, and then we'll start again. Thank you.
Okay.
It's Paul O'Connell.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Been listening to Is Abled with Dr. Stephen Nurse. This has been part 3 of his series on the war in Vietnam entitled A Letter is a Living Voice. To hear additional episodes, including his previous series on the Vietnam War, go to voiceofashon.org and look for Is Abled under the Shows tab.
Okay, Paul, are you still with us?
I'm still here.
All right. We really appreciate you doing this. Giving up part of your Saturday to talk with Steve. And it's a wonderful thing that our people listening to this are going to appreciate hearing you.
You know, Paul, we have another person here on our team, Susan Schreier, and she reads some of the letters for us. And I just came to me that she is she came up here to Vashon Island from Florida, which is where you are right now.
Oh.
So, Susan, where were you in Florida?
Palm Beach Gardens.
Okay. Mambas Garden?
Palm Beach Gardens.
Palm Beach Garden.
So
I don't know.
She's on the East Coast, I think.
And where are you?
I'm on the West Coast.
Oh, okay.
I'm in Englewood, Florida. I'm just south of Bennett.
Yes.
I'm north of Fort Myers.
Yeah, if you tell me you have a margarita in your hand right now, I'm getting the hell out of here. And, that'll be it for me for the day. But
I'll have to put a plug in for this. I haven't drank in 42, almost 43 years. I'm a recovering alcoholic.
Okay.
Wow.
Good. Good for you. That's.
I had a Marine Corps captain tell me I'm the type of guy who should never drink. That come from a Marine Corps captain who had just hoisted one up for the Marine Corps.
Oh, is that?
I don't have to say any more.
All right. Well, we'll go ahead and get this this second part done, and we'll do the same thing. It'll have the same intro and everything, and then I'll start in.
Okay.
All right.
Yep.
You look nice this morning.
Thank you. Oh, yes, wait a minute, Mr. Postman. Wait, hey, 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 Mr. Postman. Hey, Mr. Postman, look at me. Oh, yeah. Please, Mr. Postman. Oh, yeah.
Hello, this is Dr. Stephen Nurse. And this is my third and final series on the war in Vietnam, titled, A Letter is a Living Voice. We will be reading letters and documented accounts written by Vietnam veterans. These letters show all the emotion of war, from fear to anger to love and fellowship. These are only the opinions of the writers of the documents and not those of the voice of Vashon or the readers. In addition, while some of the language in the documents may appear to be racially insensitive, it is the actual language of war. It is my opinion that to use the exact language to give the listener a true understanding of the veterans' ratings and their associated emotions is extremely important. In war, we demonize our enemy through our language and our pictures. We make them inanimate, therefore easier to kill. Well, hello, this is Dr. Steve Nurse, and this is our series on Vietnam, and this is our second session. See, only the really cool guys get two sessions, but this is our second session with Paul O'Connell. And just to tell you a little bit, I was looking around, I was Googling around, which, back when... When you were in Vietnam and I was in that age too, we didn't even know what Google meant. One of the things that struck me was that I saw that Paul had written a book about his experiences in Vietnam. But even more pertinent to this program, he had written, 80 letters, Paul?
I wrote 80 letters home from Vietnam, two of them being, 80 letters and two telegrams came home.
Yeah, and so he wrote 80 letters, and those are in the book. And the book is called Between the Lines. And I'm going to give a plug for it right now. It's is it available on eBay?
Actually, it's an e-book.
Okay.
And I suggest to people, hopefully they read, if you download it on iBooks, it's free. I don't charge for it. I used to, and I haven't in years charged for it. But it's on iBooks or smashwords.com. It can be found.
And you can read all the letters in there, and I've read quite a few. The first thing that struck me was when I saw the book, and you can explain this to me, on the and how you started finding these letters, was that most of the books that I've seen that are on Vietnam show a group of grunts out in the field, or they show a plane dropping napalm, or something that's very violent. And on the front of your book, the entire front of your book is a picture of a basset hound. Now, tell me about the basset hound.
That basset hound, that actually is the shoebox cover of a pair of hush puppy shoes. And back then, and I think it was probably my father's shoebox. And my father kept every letter. Every time he got a letter from me, he put it in the shoebox. He kept all 80 letters. You'd think it was in like a file cabinet. He wrote on the envelope. He kept the envelope and everything. He wrote on the envelope in red magic marker. The first one, number one, then number two, number three, and so on, so on. And he also, in pen, wrote the date that he received the letter. And so you could tell by the date that I wrote it, and then that date, how long it took for a letter to come across. And he wrote on the box, on the shoebox cover, Paul's letters from Vietnam, 1968-1969. And then when I came home from Vietnam, he wanted to give me, that's what the hush puppy's about.
And he wanted, when you came back to Vietnam, he wanted to give the letters to you?
He wanted to give me the letters, and I told him, no, I'm all set. And I don't know what he did with them, and that was in 1969. In 1985, I was going through some counseling, and I told the counselor that, I said, I think my father still got the letters, and my counselor lit right up. He says, can you get them? I said, yeah, I'm pretty sure. I'll just go up my mother and father's house and ask them. And they asked my father if he still had the letters. He sprung out of the room. We were in the dining room. Went upstairs in the attic. I could hear him up there. He pulled down the stairs. It was pulled downstairs. Went up, come down, and handed me the letters. They were in a plastic bag from a supermarket. The bag had said on it, perishables from, probably meant for fruits or vegetables, perishables. And I went home with them. And when I got home, my kids were out back. I can still hear them. They were out in the backyard playing. And I went down in the basement, made sure I was all by myself. And I opened the box, and there they were. And I started reading them. And then I got to a certain letter. And when I read the letter, that was as far as I went. And I couldn't look at them again. That was in 1985. I didn't look at them for about another, 13, 14 years, 15 years.
And what's...
Because I could talk about...
Go ahead. What struck you that that made you put those letters away?
It's letter number 22. It was written in December 16, 1968. I'll just read a little. Give you an idea.
Sure.
Because I mentioned Jimmy Petiti. Okay. It says, hi, everybody. Don't mind this letter if it appears dirty, but that is what I'm living in. Today I received a package from you and letters from Cheryl. That's my sister. I just rattled out. Cheryl, Bobby, Sharon, and her parents, the DeLucas, Paul Files, Playboy, and Congressman Mr. Burke. The mail was dated all the way back to the 6th of December. The package was great, and the booze was beautiful. I want you to thank Cheryl and Bobby for their presence. And then the next sentence, this is what perturbed me. Well, 3 days ago, we were choppered onto Hill 500, where we were met by an NVA battalion. I need not say more except I escaped without a scratch, but I'm still shaking. I hope I never have to see a dead Marine again. I lost my best buddy from Indiana, and my other buddy got medevaced as he lost from his knees down. And when I read that, I was in shock because none of that happened. None of that happened. And I, between the lines, when, if you were to read my book, there's the letter and then there's a line says between the lines. And I tell you what really went on. I fessed up. And what I wrote was, this is what I wrote on the between the lines. This letter leaves me feeling sick today. I'm asking myself, who was I back in Vietnam and what was going on inside my head? Yes, we had boarded helicopters in Anwar and transported westward up into the mountains, but we never made contact with the enemy. Why did I claim we had? Why was I scaring my parents? Did I want to sound like a John Wayne? What was it? I know that day before we were flown into the mountains, we were briefed about the operation. We were told that reconnaissance units had spotted at least a battalion of NVA in the area we would be assaulting. Some of the guys who had been in country for some time were talking bad stuff, talking about hardcore NVA, talking about a hot LZ, reinforced bunkers, getting our effing asses shot up.
Wow.
And I won't read that. I mean, there's a lot here. And I talk about coming off that helicopter, and there was nothing. But after 3 days of hearing, I'll give you an idea of what. Now, I can flash back to Vietnam, or I have a good understanding of my PTSD and where it goes. We get in the winter a lot of storms in Massachusetts, but we're always on that rain-snow line. So we don't know if we're going to get a foot of snow or rain. And it's like hearing for 3 days that this blizzard is coming. But there's a chance of it going out to sea, but they don't see it doing that. And I get all nerved up inside about this foot of snow. And I wake up in the morning and there's nothing that went out to sea. I get so mad at the weatherman for putting me through that. And that's how I took this, of hearing that for days and days and days and days about we're gonna hit the ship and then to come off of there. But the most important thing is, who was I back in Vietnam and what was going on inside my head? Because prior to getting this shoebox of letters, I had not dealt with Vietnam. I was undiagnosed PTSD. I was sober 5 years. I had been going for alcohol counseling at the VA, but we never dealt with the war. And this is the first time this opened up the door in my head. And yet I didn't say that to anybody, that this opened up the door to my head. Because I didn't even know about doors. I didn't know any of this was... I had forgotten all about 500. I forgot about it. Absolutely forgot about it. I never even knew I was carrying that in my head until I read that letter. I put that letter back in the envelope. I put it back in the box in order and hung in the basement, my cellar in Massachusetts. When they pour a foundation, there's a steel rod. I hung that bag up on that bag of letters up on a steel rod and didn't look at them for 15 years.
I think it's interesting that you said, you know, you put the letter back in order. In other words, when you saw that and you were probably angry, probably confused, I don't want to put words in your in your mouth here, but you also realized it was a part of you, and you put it back in order. You didn't throw it down. You didn't burn it. You didn't get rid of it. You kept it. And I think that says something. Were there other letters like that struck you, or some of the other correspondence that you had?
I think I suffered from a vivid imagination sometimes. I'd sum it up this way, that when nothing was happening, I was writing and sometimes maybe making up stuff or expounding on stuff. But when things started to happen to me from like May to August, I didn't write. I didn't write for a three-week period, and my mother and father notified the American Red Cross, who notified the Marine Corps. And it filtered all the way down to my captain. We were out in the bush. We were in the field on operation. And he called me aside and said to me, "What has got into you?" I said, "Why?" "You haven't been writing your mother and father." And I'm saying to myself, how does he know? We're way out in the middle of nowhere. And he says, "I want you to sit down right now and write them." And I said, "What would I write them, sir?" Because we had really been in the thick of battle now. He says, "Write and tell them you're doing fine." Because I couldn't write. I couldn't write what was going on. And yet didn't know that. I went from, let's see, I can give you the dates here.
And that's hard for you today. I can tell by your voice. That's hard for you today.
Well, because my parents have passed on, and I've always tried to make amends to them, and I did. You know, part of my amends was I said to myself, if I get home from Vietnam, I'll change. And my father, having been on the fire department, he was so proud when I was the fire chief. He was retired now. He would come to the office, and he'd like sitting in my office, and I'd say, "Dad, I got stuff to do." "Oh, I'll just sit here," he says, "make like I'm not here." And he was so proud to be there. But I wrote a letter on June 19th, the day after my birthday, June 19th, and then I didn't write another letter till 9 July, that's July 9th of 1969. So they went that whole period of time without a letter.
Wow. Did you have questions about your own mortality at that time? I mean, did you think you were going to die?
By then I did. By then I did. I had, I don't know what we have. May 10th of 1969, sum it up, May 10th of 1969, we were carrying a dead body out, me and another guy, Dick Reed. And I looked down, and I was straddling the tripwire. That one foot, instead of scuffing and tripping the wire, had actually stepped over it. And my feet, my left and right feet between it, was the tripwire. Mm. And right then and there, my life changed. Because I had no religion other than Presbyterian on my dog tag. That's what it said. No religion, and yet I knew I wasn't alone. I then knew at that moment that there was something that I couldn't see that was with me.
Something that lifted your foot over that wire.
Yeah, and this sounds strange. Some people out there might say, "Whoa, where's he coming from?" I had heard a voice that said, "Look down." Now, afterwards, my mind just might wanted to make that up. I don't know, but I heard a voice. It said, "Look down." And when I looked down, that's what I saw. Now, that happened May 10th. And the next, I wrote a letter May 9th. And the next letter was May 21st. So I go 11 days after that incident before I could write a letter home. And there was no excuse not to.
Wow. And, you know, you're a parent, I'm a parent. For your parents too, there must have been nothing more painful than not to have correspondence. You know, my daughter is 43, and she drives the car when she comes home, and I still worry about her. She's 43, and I still worry about her at 10 o'clock. Why she's not home? Where is she? You know, so that you know, I think your realization of that is really, really very spot on. You felt bad that, it's so nice that your dad's sending your office there. And I bet he said something. I bet he wasn't just a bump on the wall.
No, he wasn't. He wasn't.
Did he have advice for you?
You know what? He didn't have any advice. I left that whole fire department mystified because they knew nobody in the city of Quincy. There wasn't anybody who didn't know my story. If you were in the Marine Corps in Quincy, you were in. There was a World War II and Korean vets within the municipality. And my father one time said to me when I was a chief, he looked at me and said, "You know, you're aloof." And another guy told me I was an enigma. And this is before Google. I had to Google that. I had to look Enigma. I had to look that up. But if I can read a letter just to sum up, not to sum up, but to, I told you 10 May, most important date in my life. In fact, my higher power I call May 10th. So here it is. I've written when nothing's happened. I have all those stories about guys getting killed and this and that. May 21st, the next letter I write after two guys have been killed, and I've seen them first. I put their body, what was left of bodies, and I had a sergeant say, "Just divvy up the parts." It was that kind of scene.
Wow.
On 21 May 69, this is what I write. "Dear family, well, it's me again. I'm sitting on top of Hill 198 waiting for the gooks to rocket the NWR. I'm in charge of 9 people, and we are supposed to keep our eyes open for rocket flashes. Then I get on the radio and call an artillery on the position. Right now, I'm the most experienced man in the first platoon, as all my buddies have jobs in the rear. They will be going home soon. Oh, it's not PFC anymore. I'm now Lance Corporal O'Connell. Pretty good. I made it the other day. I'm enclosing the certificate plus my Purple Heart certificate. They are pretty dirty, but who cares? The Bronze Star ceremony should be before I come home. These things take time. Well, I've been receiving all the mail you've been sending. It takes a little longer, but I still get it. I might as well tell you that me and Sharon are thrilled. The impression she gives me is that she's too busy with some other guy, so she can't write too much. So I wrote her and told her where to go. At least I can say I didn't receive a dear John. I don't care anyway, because do you remember the girl I met on R&R who worked for TWA? Well, I got a package from her a few days ago. I write her when I can. When I come home and leave, I'm going to visit her, and I want to bring her home so you people can meet her. She's out of this world. Well, can't think of much more to say. I'll write when I can."
Wow.
I want to read something more important here.
Okay.
I had written my Sharon after that, a Dear John. I wrote the Dear John after May 10th. I think I was in shock. But the last paragraph of Between the Lines says, "I had declared that Sharon and I were done. I always thought she had been the one to end it, but when I reread this letter in 1996, I realized I might have been the one who had called it quits. I sure wanted my parents to think so, and I wanted my parents to think I was fine with the breakup, because I had a new girlfriend, the airline stewardess, who was nothing more than a fantasy, a battle dressing for an enormous wound to my heart. I went on R&R to Hawaii and met an airline stewardess from TWRA, and I shared like one drink with her, and that was it. So every time I would read one of these letters, I had to re-question, who was I back in Vietnam? That's how I dealt with life. I didn't deal with it.
And did you say you also got the Bronze Star?
I was put in for the Bronze Star that I never got, because that's a whole nother story, that I quit fighting. June 26th, 1969, I said, I'm not fighting anymore. I had been in a cave, and I wasn't coming out. And my platoon sergeant squashed that Bronze Star.
Wow. And what were you
This is after I had written home I was going to get a Bronze Star, because I was told I was going to get a Bronze Star.
And what was it? What was your action to for them to put you up for the Bronze Star?
What was the action?
Yes.
We had, how much time you got?
I don't know. Rick will tell us. 4 minutes. But I'm very interested in, just go ahead and let me know.
Well, I'm looking.
That's okay.
It says here, this is what happened. During the late afternoon of May 4th, I wrote home in a letter. I said, well, at 3:30 a.m. on the 5th, my company and Bravo 15 moved into the Phu Duc area of Vien Hoa and surrounded a company of the 5th Viet Cong Regiment. At about 6 a.m., we moved out, and I was about 20 yards from a bunker when a BC started running until I put an automatic burst up his back and hit. Here is where I want it. I saw another one run for a stream, so I chased him, but couldn't find him until he came up for air right at my feet. So I kind of did him too. Then me and another guy get caught. Guy got in the water and captured 4 BC and 1 BC nurse. So there you have it. Well, got to go for now, but you might as well keep writing.
Wow.
Love, Paul.
Wow.
But all those killings, I wasn't, my friends did them. I did get in the water.
Wow.
I mean, so his between the lines, here's really what went on. During the late afternoon, May 4th, the word was passed that my company was going to participate in an operation called Muskogee Medals. Company was to operate in conjunction with Bravo Company, 1st Battalion, 5th Marine. Sometime after dark, my company moved towards a village suspected of being occupied by an undisclosed number of VC, most likely mingled in with the women and children. The gunny had said the VC were probably looking for a little R&R. He said, you know, a one-nighter to lift their spirit, like we all know it does. The word was that we were going to surround one half of the village while Bravo Company surrounded the other half. I had been told many times about villages being infested with the enemy, and we would surround the village at night and then move in the next day to find only women and children. I figured this was going to be another one of those fruitless excursions, which had a way of leaving me feeling frustrated by not being able to catch up to the enemy, especially as the wounds from exploding booby traps spread upon the countryside by the VC continued to mount. Other than during training back in the States, I had never camouflaged my face until Operation Muskogee Medals. Having no actual grease paint, we used mud, and the carbon we got from breaking apart used up PRC-25 radio batteries, which had a large carbon content. We rubbed the mud and carbon on our faces and the back of our neck and hands. We also made sure our shirt sleeves would roll down all the way to our wrists and buttons. Also, the top button of the shirt was fastened. Thus, hopefully, there would be no reflection from our skin to give ourselves away to the VC. We changed location several times during the night in case the enemy had learned of our presence. One time, we even moved in the opposite direction of our objective to keep the enemy from knowing our real intentions. Our final move was around 0300 hours. We circled back around into the position behind the protection of the paddy dike. Supposedly, the village was to our front, but in the dark, we could not see it. In the dark, all we could see was nothing. There was no illumination in the sky this night. There would be no shadow to spook our weary eyes. Weary as our sleep had been at a minimum. Pre-dawn light to our rear was waking a brand new day for us and the Vietnamese in the village as the scene before our eyes slowly began to brighten. Into view came the edge of the paddy dike and a rice paddy with the slightest hint of reflection from a puddle or two. Rice paddy grew even larger than it had first appeared. Finally, there was the silhouette of a tree line with a few distinguishable palm trees taller than bamboo, and then the idyllic village itself with its small group of huts. Just before the invasion began, a single-engine prop-driven airplane was heard circling the area, a scout plane equipped with loudspeakers which allowed psychological rhetoric to be amplified down upon the enemy. Vietnamese language bombarding the village was foreign to my ears, but whatever the message was, human figures, black-clad, puffed up into view in the village. Figures were running all about, even into one another. The village was a scene of chaos, panic, people disturbed by what they had heard coming from the sky above. For some of those who were running, they would have been so much better off if they had simply sat themselves down and waited with their hands high in the air, indicating surrender. But their hopeless plea did nothing but declare them guilty, and the sentence was death. A lone figure clad in black pajamas and a conical-shaped hat, which he was trying with one hand to keep from flying off his head, was running on a paddy dike straight for us. The poor soul was without the knowledge that an entire company of Marines were in hiding, and every one of their weapons were expertly trained on his upper torso and head. Taken into account, he was a moving target. Everyone was just waiting for the order to open fire. When the order was given, the volley of fire lasted but a split second as the enemy's body was practically obliterated. Those slowing the trigger had nothing to shoot at. The enemy had dropped out of the picture that fast.
Wow.
Immediately after the order to cease fire had been given, an order I only heard once while I was in the Vietnam, bellowed out, charge. Up and over the paddy dike we went. We were in a frontal assault. It was imperative to keep abreast of the Marines at either side of one another, but it was difficult as we slogged through the mud of the rice paddy. Several Marines stopped briefly to look at the body which had just been killed, but the order was to keep moving. As we came up out of the rice paddy and began our move over dry ground, we had to slow our pace to keep an eye out for where we were stepping, as booby traps were a good possibility here.
Is that the
we
same?
Could only hope we, well,
can I ask you, is that the same type of booby trap that you were talking about before, with the tripwire?
Yeah, they would be like that. Yeah.
Wow.
We could only hope we were not being sucked into a minefield. From behind an earthen mound to my left front, but directly to the front of a Marine by the last name of Malloy, who had been in Vietnam for about a month, a black-clad figure popped up and broke into a run, trying to flee in a straight line. Zigzagging would have given him a chance of escaping. From about 20 yards away, Malloy took aim at the fleeing figure. A single shot from Malloy's rifle dropped the black-clad figure in its tracks. Although it was hard to tell if the figure had dropped into hiding or if he had been hit, a Marine to the left of Malloy yelled out with excitement, You got him. You just blew his friggin' head off. I had not seen what this excited Marine had seen, but I wanted to see if he actually knew what he was talking about. So I charged forward towards where I suspected the body to be. Splayed out face down on the ground was a black-clad body that I wanted to imagine had moved or at least twitched, anything that had given me a reason to fire my weapon. Seeing none, but with adrenaline coursing through my body, I opened fire anyway, just for the hell of it. I emptied a magazine of M16 with one automatic burst into the body, firing from head to toe while I screamed out like a wild banshee. When Malloy came up to me, I said to him, "The killer's still yours. I was just making sure he was dead." Malloy just nodded his head slightly. Sometime later, he told a friend of his that he did not want credit for the kill. He said he did not want it hanging over his head for the rest of his life.
Wow.
By the looks of what I had written in my letter, it looks like I had no qualms with being the killer.
Wow. Thank you. Thank you, Paul. I think that that's a good way to maybe not a good way to stop our interview here, but I think it leaves the feelings that and the mixture of feelings that we want to leave in this. So let's close her up, and then after the we close her up, we'll have a little bit of silence, and then we'll talk again soon. And thank you, Paul O'Connell, for all of your honesty, your integrity, and your service to our country. Thank you.
No, I thank you for allowing me to tell not my story, but the story of other Marines and other 18 and 19-year-olds. I'll just say I go to reunions, and you know what? We understand that the guys I was with, there wasn't one guy with a high school diploma other than the officers. There wasn't one of us had a high school diploma.
Wow.
And we were all 18. Today, we're all 72 going on 73, those alive.
That's where I am. Well, hang in there and keep staying vertical. And thanks again for your time, Paul.
You're welcome.
We're out of here. Thank you.
Been listening to Is Abled with Dr. Stephen Nurse. This has been part 3 of his series on the war in Vietnam entitled A Letter is a Living Voice. To hear additional episodes, including his previous series on the Vietnam War, go to voiceofashon.org and look for Is Abled under the Shows tab.